Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Amanda Hester is CEO and co-founder of Food 52, a food, home, and lifestyle brand. And now in its 10th year, right, 10th year, yeah. Food 52 has evolved widely from the recipe sharing site it used to be and recently closed a very large funding round, which we'll talk about later. Amanda and I will be picking up where UK food writer Sybil Kapoor and I left off last week. Last week we talked about what taste means, how it is biologically, culturally, and socially constructed, and why it's important to continually challenge our own. But today we'll be talking about how taste is determined in our supposedly algorithmically optimized world, if our taste is truly unique, and whether SEO-driven content hurts or helps us. Welcome to the show, Amanda.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
I had two sips of that coffee and I feel great. I'm back. I was kind of sleepy, but I'm back. So first, some housekeeping for people unfamiliar with Food 52. Can you talk about what it is, what problems you were trying to solve when leaving the New York Times back then, and what it looked like back then?
Okay. So, I'll start with today and then go back. So Food 52 is a comprehensive resource for people who see food at the center of a well-lived life. And that may sound kind of broad, and that's quite intentional, because that's what we saw, was that, if you rewind 10 years, and actually just listening to the intro realized that Heritage Radio started 10 years ago also. They were way ahead on the podcast front, weren't they? Mm-hmm. Meryl Stubbs, my co-founder, and I, we had been food journalists, food writers, also trained cooks. And, one of the things that we do as a food writer is you're constantly connecting dots of like what's happening culturally and in this, in the food world, and connecting them, seeing them before the average reader does, connecting the dots for them and then synthesizing this into stories to say, like, here's what you should be paying. Like, there's lots of noise, but this is what you should be paying attention to, because this is kind of happening and this will have an influence on what's next, right? That's sort of a very kind of common pattern of sort of story formation when you're writing. And so it was very much a mindset that Meryl and I were in, and I think that this helped us actually see what we felt like was this really huge shift in food. Yes, food was everyone was aware that food was becoming more popular, but I think people didn't really see how kind of broad and deep it was going to shift the way Americans identify themselves and the way that they lived their, how they essentially defined their lifestyles, right? So it's not just about like that you were going to be eating different foods at the dinner table, but that in fact you were going to design your kitchen differently and your home, you were going to entertain with friends differently, you were going to travel differently, you were going to want to know different things when you shopped for food, and that it was very much like going to be woven into every aspect of the way you lived. And so that instead of being this kind of like niche passion, which is the way it had been treated in kind of food media and certainly in retail, it was going to be something bigger. And we felt like there was a huge opportunity to serve people selfishly, like people like us, because we felt like we weren't being served well, with a destination that could be this really fantastic, trustworthy resource, place that you get inspiration, you could discover products, you could, you know, come across new ideas, and also that was very community driven, because that was another big shift, was that, you know, we could see that, you know, readers, shoppers, you know, just everyday people no longer wanted to be broadcast at, whether that meant, you know, somebody putting a product in front of them or an article to read, that they wanted interaction. And they also wanted to be acknowledged for their, you know, for their expertise and their input. And we felt like there was a way to kind of combine these notions into a site and a brand that wouldn't be a media company or wouldn't be necessarily a retail commerce company, but would really be this kind of this world that people felt like had a sense of place and that people could feel connected to and that could evolve along with their, you know, cooking and how they were living or how they were traveling. And so we had a big, you know, and obviously our vision kind of also evolved over time, but, you know, we had this very, you know, I think critical insight that led us to start building this company. So that's, and you know, it's, we're 10 years in and we feel like we have this really strong foundation built. And it definitely has resonated with people and we have really great engagement and, you know, we continue to grow and it feels exciting because it feels like, you know, we sort of tapped into something early and now it's a, you know, a matter of, continuing to listen to people and give them what they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said something really interesting, which is that you kind of identified that people like to be seen and like to be acknowledged for their kind of knowledge about food and their own culinary knowledge that they you know, came up with. And which I think we see again today with Instagram, like restoring people or like Alison Roman, I'm thinking of. Like, I feel like that's really key to how she got big is mm-hmm. she saw people cooking her own food. And so what did Food 52 look like in the beginning and how did you kind of acknowledge home cooks and their kind of expertise?
Yeah. So traditionally in media, it was very much the home cook was kind of treated as someone who was like a novice and who didn't really know what they were doing and really needed to have their hand held. And while... sure, all of us have needed to have our hand held in the kitchen at some point or another. We're in the kitchen every day, you know, and people in their homes, they do know a lot. They know a lot about like what their limitations are, what their tastes are, what they want to eat, what they're not, you know, willing to do, feels like a sense of adventure and what feels like a chore. Right. And so, I think that, interestingly, we actually got a lot of inspiration from the New York Times food archives that go back actually to the 1850s, and specifically to the archives that were from 1850 to about 1900, because I would say probably 90 to 95% of the food coverage in the Times during that period, which was immense, it was every day, was crowdsourced. From readers. So the recipes primarily came from readers. And they were very much like, you know, tweets. They were, you know, the recipes would come in, they'd be very kind of punctuated because there was an assumption that everyone knew how to cook because, you know, no one had a microwave then. Everyone had to cook in order, you know, there weren't places to take out food. So they had these very punctuated recipes that were, you know, opinionated, had a lot of personal style, and there were regular voices that you would see appear again and again. And we just thought, well, that's amazing because everyone thinks that crowdsourcing is this, you know, creation from the internet. But of course, it's not at all. And, you know, obviously there have been community cookbooks for decades and, we just felt like there was, especially with food kind of really catching on fire, culturally, we felt like there was an opportunity to really celebrate home cooks. So in the beginning, because we really focus on developing content first and really building a relationship with readers and establishing our brand voice and aesthetic, we focus on content and specifically we started with recipe contests because we felt like that was a really good way to get people involved. And and it didn't mean that everyone, to be involved, you had to add a recipe to Food 52. To be involved, you could, you know, vote on one of our recipe contests or... you could be a community tester, or you could comment on the recipe. There were lots of ways to participate, and we felt like every every avenue of participation had value to future readers, right? Because if a recipe comes in from a community member and then it's, you know, tested by community members, it wins a contest, it, you know, gets photographed by us, it you know, we basically gave it more prominence in our search engine and also just more prominence on the site in general. And it was a way of kind of curating the content that was coming in. And so that anyone who was new to Food 52 could more easily find what was deemed by the community great quality content. And that was something that really hadn't been done before. And we felt like it was a really, the way we thought of it was constructive contributions as opposed to just like a free-for-all kind of chat room. Because those existed, right? We felt like there was a way to kind of harness the power of community to actually create better content together. And then obviously we've gone from that to, you know, we've hired a lot of our community recipe contributors to be blog contributors. They've gone on, some of them have written cookbooks for us. Some of them have done video with us. You know, they've also gone on and done their own books and TV shows and things like that. So it was really this kind of like engine of kind of creative talent. And now we actually create products in collaboration with our community. So we're obviously big believers in community and in valuing, kind of everyone's input.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to backtrack, you said you and Merrill started the site with the intention of it being very community-minded, that you didn't want to start another food media brand, but it's kind of inadvertently become that. So can you talk about the current food media landscape and why Food 52 has evolved as it has to kind of answer these questions that are around us right now?
Sure. And sorry, just to kind of correct what I didn't mean necessarily that we wouldn't be a media company. It's just that we wouldn't be only a media company. Like we would have a lot, we were really focused on kind of the end consumer. In other words, like the end consumer doesn't care like, oh, is this a media company or is this a store or is this an events platform? What they care about is like, are they getting what they want, right? Am I getting the information I want, the inspiration I want, the sense of community, the sense of connection? And so that's really like, we didn't go into building this company at like from a like MBA business approach of like starting with a business model and then sort of figuring out what the product would be. Like we started with what the product is and then worked back, and we really had to believe that if we served people well in a way that they found engaging and actually additive to their lives, a business model would follow. And obviously we had some sense of like how you make money in media or how you make money with commerce, but we didn't want to be driven by that. We wanted to be driven by what we were actually providing people. Sorry, I think I've gone off track now and I didn't answer your question. It's today's media landscape. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's been amazing to see what has happened. I mean, there have been great things that have happened in media and then also like some pretty terrible things that have happened in media over the past decade. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an industry that has been and continues to be in turmoil. It's very challenged. Its business model is very challenged. But despite that, and I think actually, you know, and I'm a big believer that constraints really inspire creativity. And in some ways, media has, I think, never been better because of the constraints. Like people have had to be really creative about what they're putting out into the world. And they've had to work harder to like get people's attention and to create things that are actually kind of useful and interesting to readers. And, you know, it's like the under the hood is not so pretty because of course it's meant like, you know, a lot of really strained resources and layoffs and tough times. But I actually think that, in food media, you know, Eater was around obviously when we started, but I think that Eater has become a real kind of force in the food world and has become a really sort of, you know, go-to resource. And you know, I find that it's you know, it's something that I turn to regularly. I think the New York Times creating their recipe app has been incredibly powerful, and they really kind of tapped into their, they really kind of leaned into their strengths. You know, I was talking to Sam Sifton recently, and he was saying how, you know, they've had amazing writers over, I mean, for decades and decades and decades. And in the moment, those stories that those writers write are, you know, have resonance, and they're really important and often can, you know, be incredibly popular. But what stays around are the recipes. Mm-hmm. And people don't necessarily care if it was a Mark Bittman or an Alison Roman or a Molly O'Neill recipe. What they care is that it's like an amazing recipe, right? And it's not that people don't have loyalty to specific writers' recipes, but ultimately it's these recipes become, they take on their own lives. And, they, you know, they get passed along among families and friends, and it's this really kind of, you know, incredibly useful and important part of people's lives, right? Because they become part of people's family traditions. And so they recognize that, and that's when they went after building the cooking app. And it's been obviously a huge success. So they've done, I think, really great things. You know, Bon Appetit has transformed, actually, you know, basically at around, I think around the same time, maybe they started a little bit early. I'm trying to remember exactly when Adam Rappaport took over Bon App, but, you know, they've done a phenomenal job of, like, you know, really, I think capturing the sort of zeitgeist in food at, you know, at the moment, and making it accessible, and making food, not just like stylish, but fun. And, yeah, I mean, I just think, like, there's been a lot of great work, coming at food and from like lots of different angles. Obviously Netflix has done amazing things telling stories about the food world. Yeah, I mean, I think it's been actually like this great moment. And so it feels really good to be a part of that. Obviously, you know, I think that the thing for us is to just stay very focused on, we're very much about the home and how people who care about, you know, cooking and their homes, how they think, how they kind of see the world and what's important to them, and not trying to like kind of be everything to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's actually talk about the proliferation of storytelling modes that each brand is kind of becoming known for. Like when I want a good recipe, I know to turn to the New York Times. If I want kind of not even that food-centric content, but entertaining content, I would watch a Bon Appetit video. And so can you talk about how these, or how you might presume these choices are made, and what each different storytelling mode kind of serves the audience member?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it comes down to brand and loyalty and trust. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, that this is what we were very much focused on from the very beginning, because we felt like this was, at the time that we started Food 52, was incredibly lacking, which was that people were treating the internet as this kind of like mechanism for reaching people, as opposed to a place where you can, you know, create a real sense of place in a world and a place to really connect deeply with people. Food on the internet at the time was very much like these kind of like recipe sites that, you know, that were very utilitarian, as opposed to ones where you felt like any kind of sense of emotion or connection, and really the places that were doing that really well at the time were food blogs. And so I think that food blogs, and then companies like ours really started to redefine what food and the internet could look like and mean for people in their lives. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of amazing choices now, and I think it really comes down to that sense of trust. Like, if you trust the New York Times cooking app for recipes, that's a huge success that they've accomplished, right? Because we do have so many choices, so that if that's the first place you think of, that's great. I think similarly, like, if you're looking for a restaurant, if you're like looking for a restaurant in a neighborhood you haven't been to, going, you know, turning to Eater, like, they've won when mm-hmm. you think of them, right. As opposed to, it's basically like, sure, all of these brands, including ours, want to come up first if you're Googling, but ideally you don't have to Google, you'll just think of us. And so I think that the sort of recognition and development of brands digitally has, you know, it's taken a long time. And I think that it's great to see that it's happening now, because this is something that has existed in traditional media for a really long time. Like Condé Nast, like people read Condé Nast magazines because they trusted them as an authority, and for a certain level of aesthetic and style and curation. And I think that what you're seeing now in food media is that is happening, or that has now exists online, and it really didn't 10 years ago. Mm-hmm.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back after a short break.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Linda Liu, and I'm the host of Feast Meets West, the show that celebrates Asian culture through the lens of food here on HRN. Listen to episodes like The Evolution of Chinatown with Numwa Tea Parlor's Wilson Tang and New York Times Elaine Chen. Catch our ongoing series, Women in Asian Food, and spotlight episodes with our heroes like Anita Lowe. You can find Feast Meets West wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Meant to Be Eaten. I'm speaking with Amanda Hester, and we were just talking about the current food media landscape and how brands have really, in the past 10 years, kind of worked to develop their presence online. And I want to kind of get into the future of the food media landscape. What do you see for it, and how do you see what's taking place now contributing to where we'll go?
Yeah. I would say throughout media, what's happening is just a lot of consolidation, and there's obviously a lot of downward pressure on companies to find diverse revenue streams. And so I think I do think it is going to be a survival of the fittest. And I do have a personal fear that like a lot of companies are going to get swallowed up by larger media companies. And not that that's, it's just, it's inevitable that some of the experimentation and really strong identity building that has happened with some of the more startup media brands will get diluted, and so it could be a less interesting period ahead. But I also think, you know, the ones who figure it out will become the kind of resources that I think traditional media was, you know, 20 years ago, where it's the kind of thing that, you know, you're a devoted reader for life. And I think that is something that we're starting to feel more, that people's like devotion and loyalty to these titles online is sort of sinking in more deeply than I think, you know, there is something with the internet that people feel like is a little a bit ephemeral. And I think people are looking for something that's less so these days. And so it could be sort of this interesting dovetailing of sort of timing of like changes in media and also public sentiment, making for much sort of stronger, longer lasting brands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we kind of set the scene for why food media has grown to not being solely a niche interest, but kind of taking place in, or having an important place in many people's lives. And so, but still, it's kind of a big deal that investment group took interest in Food 52 and food media company. And so can you talk about why that's a big deal and what this might mean?
Sure. You know, so we took on a majority investment from the Chernin Group. And they have an investment thesis that, you know, they really believe in brands with passionate audiences that have grown organically. And that's, you know, very much who we are. Mm-hmm. And if you look across the companies that they've invested in, they might seem on the surface wildly different because they're, you know, across like sports and, you know, anime and things like that. But we all share this sort of core fan base. And so, you know, it's been really fascinating for Meryl and me to see, like, over the years, you know, when we first started and we were raising a seed round, you know, we bootstrapped the company first for the first 18 months, and then we decided to raise a seed round. And, like, no one wanted to talk to anyone in media then. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was as if, you know, sort of media was dead, and nobody actually was interested in food at the time. And it wasn't... probably until like I would say five or six years ago that then media suddenly took off, and then there was tons of investment in media. And actually, media is now and back where it was when we were first. So you know, there's all these kind of like investing trends that, you know, you're trying to build your company, but your resources are dependent on the sort of shifting winds of the investment community. And so we've never raised a lot of money. And so when TCG came to us, we didn't, you know, when you get to a sort of certain size, a lot of investment firms are reaching out, and sometimes they're just trying to kind of keep an ear to the ground, and sometimes they're trying to get some comps from you for another investment they're looking at. Like, you never really know how sincere their interest is. And sometimes they are just wanting to keep track of you so that when you get to a certain size and you're kind of, you fit their size investment, they can have a real conversation with you. So they reached out cold, and we didn't know that much about them at the time. But then once we started talking, and we could sort of see where their interests were, it was incredibly appealing to us, because one of the challenges we've had as a company is we felt that investors didn't understand what we were trying to build. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard to kind of find the right fit of like investors who had an investment thesis that like fit with us, where they appreciated the kind of blood, sweat, and tears it takes to grow organically, and that we weren't going to just throw money at marketing, no matter how much money they gave us. And that also, like, that also meant, like, we have grown very fast, but, like, not as fast as you can if you just throw money at marketing. Mm-hmm. And so that we weren't willing to sacrifice our kind of authenticity for that kind of growth. And so, anyway, so it's, you know, I think it's been a great validation, really, of like what we've been building and where we're going, and also the opportunity ahead of us to have a company put so much money behind a company like ours, which again, like, has this, you know, mixed model. You know, for many years, investors would say to us, you know, well, like, okay, yes, we understand you have commerce and we understand you have media, but which are you? Because you have to pick a lane. Hmm. One has to be dominant. And we always refused to really answer that question, because we felt like it wasn't even a question. It was really a statement to us. And we felt like we just disagreed. So we agreed to disagree, that, in fact, you know, we were building this resource, and that you had to see it that way. And we were building this brand that connected with people. And if you didn't, then it probably wasn't going to be a good partnership. Anyway, TCG really did understand that. I mean, that's why they reached out, because they already understood that about what we were building. And so it was sort of this perfect match and this perfect timing, because, you know, we also had got, you know, we're about 100 people now, and you know, our revenue is, you know, is pretty significant, and we're moving into kind of a growth phase, and so it's really great to, you know, have partners who understand that and are willing to you know, really invest in that, and don't want us to just pour it all into marketing.
Yeah, so I'm actually going to make you choose, and we're going to talk about content now.
Okay.
So can you talk about, for people who don't know, what is SEO-driven content?
Oh, uh-huh.
And yeah, let's start there.
Yeah, so SEO stands for Search Engine Optimization, and what that means is, you know, essentially kind of figuring out the puzzle of Google's algorithm, mm-hmm. so that when someone puts in search terms, your content will come up as high as possible on, and ideally on the first page, and then as high as possible on the first page. And Google never reveals, you know, exactly what they're looking for. And it also changes a lot. So it, there are people who are SEO experts who help you figure that out. And there are also like consulting firms who like you can hire, and they'll like look at how you're, I mean, there's a lot of different factors that play into it, but it can, you know, be how like your articles are titled, how they're tagged, how your pages are structured. You know, it's, the thing that I would say, one very positive thing is that over time, Google has continually kind of tweaked its algorithm to reward higher quality content, mm-hmm. as it has figured out what higher quality content is. And I would, you know, I think probably there are plenty of people who would argue that, you know, it's not totally there yet, but it has, you know, over the course of our business, we've seen it get, you know, better and better. And, you know, because now if you look for a recipe, I'm going to make something up and I don't know what the results are, but let's just say chocolate pudding pie, which is a recipe I was just looking at in Bon Appetit, in their newsletter. But, you know, you will see smaller blogs now on the first page. So they've done work to make sure that they're rewarding the content itself, as opposed to just these giant sites who have SEO experts on their team, mm-hmm. who are constantly, you know, playing the sort of game of SEO.
Mm-hmm. It kind of feels like chicken or the egg almost, though, because I then go to those small blogs and find that they feel very SEO driven, where they have a ton of text and, you know, a lot of tagged photos, or I don't know how they're doing it. And so do you think,
they probably are somewhat aware, mm-hmm. or, you know, it, or if not fully aware of like what needs to be done, and maybe they pay attention to the sort of Google SEO trends. I mean, there are lots of people who blog about that specifically, and then there's lots of information about like what you should be or should not be doing, you know, these days. You know, I think the way like we see it is we want to be optimized as much as we can without it compromising what our, mm-hmm. our sort of intent is. And really the reason we want to do it is mostly so that if somebody's Googling something, that means they don't know a great resource for that, whatever they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And so we want people to be able to discover us as a resource and ideally answer that question that they have in the moment, but also get sort of drawn into our world and like, oh, hey, here's this, you know, this place that I didn't know about. And maybe, you know, next time I'm looking for a recipe or I'm asking a question about, you know, how to season my cast iron pans, I'll know to come here. Mm-hmm. So that's our goal is more of like a long game. Like, sure, that the click in the moment, like it has value, but it doesn't really have a ton of value if people are just like getting their answer and leaving and never coming back. Mm-hmm. Again, that, you know, there are sort of two schools of thought in media. There are the sort of bigger media brands that you know, they are really reliant on having huge amounts of traffic, and so they're not all of them, but many are very focused on just getting you to click on those on the all those Google searches and just getting that hit so that they can get that impression for their ad sales. You know, that is one way to kind of, guarantee your revenue stream. I think that we are much more focused on, yes, of course, clicks matter and impressions matter to us, but we want to build relationships with people over time. So, you know, and I think you see these two schools of thought pretty vividly in media, across all media, not mm-hmm. just in food.
Yeah, as kind of an outside observer, when I think of a food media brand using or even considering SEO-driven content, I would almost believe that you don't care so much for it, right? Like if
but
you
we
already
do, like we name stories according to, like, you know, we'll study, like, you know, what kind of words are going to perform better, and we might, you know, title something. So it's not that we don't. It's mm-hmm. but we don't want it dictating like all of our content, right. You know.
Yeah. So as food media is now, or Food 52 has now become this trusted resource for many readers. How much do you think you're observing SEO-driven content trends versus kind of being the ones that are forecasting?
Yeah. So we hired our first SEO expert mm-hmm. this past year. And she's been amazing because I think she's come at it very much. She came from Hearst and you know, Hearst produces, you know, tons of great quality content. They have like whole SEO teams, but you know, she understood, you know, I think it's a matter of sort of understanding what you're trying to accomplish, and then working back from there. But, you know, there are some changes that we have not been able to make, but that will help our search results. For instance, and I don't want to go too deep on this because I can't. you know, there's something about like sort of the dates of articles, and I think that the way we display dates is like too prominent. Mm-hmm. So it would require some engineering work. But once we do that, it'll help surface some older articles that could be incredibly relevant to someone today. And you know, because we're in a topic area that actually there's a lot of evergreen content, and so it's something that you have to. One of the things that Google rewards is like new, fresh content, right? And so if you have an article that's 10 years old, even though it actually may answer your question, they're going to reward the one that was written, you know, that has the same kind of quality of content that might have been written yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so it's things like that. Like there are a lot of kind of tweaks that don't necessarily, they don't impact the content itself, but it impacts how it plays. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, she has really focused on those kinds of first lower, like kind of lower hanging fruit, and then sort of going deeper into things that will have a big impact on us without us compromising our standards.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of really exciting to hear. Instead of rewarding the contribution of digital trash out into the world, rewarding content that's already fine and just needs like a little love, revival.
And some of it is like just, you know, giving it a new, you know, taking something like an older piece of content, like an older recipe, and like, you know, giving it the head note of refresh, or mm-hmm. you know, giving it some sort of more recent context that is actually additive, not just kind of fluff. Mm-hmm.
So we talked a lot about the future of food media, but what do you see for the future of home cooking?
So we are obviously very bullish, and not just to serve our own purposes, but actually because home itself is becoming a more and more culturally a focus for people. And there are a number of factors for that. One is that entertainment, like now you can get pretty much any kind of, you know, movie, television show, game at home. You don't have to go out. People choose to go out. They did, you know, you used to have to go to the movies if you wanted to see a movie. And so entertaining at home has become a much bigger thing, and is only going to kind of continue. Mm-hmm. Also, I think just given the sort of global political climate, home has become much more of a sanctuary for people and like a necessary oasis. Mm-hmm. So that's a big cultural shift that I you know, we can see is obviously not going to probably reverse itself anytime soon. And then, you know, I think also just in, you know, the age of Instagram and where, you know, people like the term house proud used to be a thing that was used in kind of shelter magazines. You know, if you were house proud, you like, you know, you took kind of, you know, care of your home. You put a lot of attention and time into making your home stylish or comfortable or whatever it was. It was an expression of you, you know, of who you are. And the internet has really, and Instagram specifically, and Pinterest has like really brought that to life. And I think has really inspired a lot of people to see their homes as a real reflection of who they are and a really great way, great creative outlet for expressing themselves. And so we feel like people's homes and, you know, people want to show off their homes and have people over. And it's just going to become a bigger and bigger focus for people. And so as part of that, cooking is naturally connected. And obviously cooking has you know, taken off in enormous ways over the past decade. I think that cooking, the difference is, and you know, this existed, I think, even when we were starting the company, but is only kind of continuing to evolve and refine, is that, you know, people don't have to cook as much. It's really a choice. It's like a lifestyle choice. Mm-hmm. And so there's less of the, like, you know, cooking because you have to get dinner. I mean, obviously, like, you know, yes, it still exists that people have to get dinner on the table, but there's also, you know, a whole, like, you know, there are people who are not, you know, married with kids who are interested in cooking now. It's not something you just do out of necessity, but you do by choice. And I think that it's led to a lot of exploration in cooking. I think that there's, like, people are so much more interested in diverse cuisines and experimenting. And again, like, seeing food as this chance to express who they are and what they like and they don't like. And there's artistry to it. And I, you know, it's, to us, we feel like it's such an incredibly exciting time to be in this field. And to really just find ways to kind of inspire people and support them in this interest, and to also, like, make, you know, like, help people feel kind of liberated to take on whatever culinary challenge they want to, you know, whether it's like the perfect avocado toast or it's like some instant pot dish or, you know, really mastering bread baking at home.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the only thing needed to take house proud from when was that? When that
I was probably, like, you know, in the 90s, yeah.
From the 90s to now is just put a hashtag in front of it. You know? Hashtag house proud.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny that you hadn't heard that term before. I mean, no. It's not, it doesn't surprise me now, but yeah, mm-hmm. It was sort of a thing that people would say.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I think this is a good way to end. Thank you so much for joining me today, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a treat.
Meant to be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.